Let's start with reviewing the Jacobi principle that Julian mentioned in his talk.
It's, if you want, a way of rewriting in a timeless way a dynamical theory, in this case, a theory of particles in classical dynamics. And I have that this line element defines a metric on the configuration space. And what I get is that the dynamical problem of finding the trajectories of the system is reduced to a geometrical problem, the one of finding the geodesics of this metric. So the metric that has, well, not this metric exactly, is modulated by this function, which is a constant minus the potential. And of course here you have, first of all, reparametrization invariance. I can write this thing as a velocity, dq by d lambda, and integrate over lambda, which is my parameter, an internal parameter. And this action is explicitly reparametrization invariant. Now, it basically enforces Julian's notion of timelessness in physics. Now, Julian also spoke about a counterfactual history. Let's imagine that I'm a mathematician of the 19th century. I know Riemannian geometry, and I don't know nothing about special relativity or general relativity. And I want to build up a field theory using the metric of space. I want to speak about space-time and some natural geometrical objects that are at my disposal. And I want it to be reparametrization invariant in the way that the Jacobi action is for particle dynamics. I will probably write something like this. It's the local square root that Julian showed in his talk. It is a product of the square root of the potential term and the square root of the kinetic term. For the kinetic term, I'm basically, this is the most natural choice, in which G is the DeWitt supermetric. And I will comment later about this star of our conference, which is this small lambda, this parameter that you're apparently free to set in this setting. Now, for you, I will just want something that is basically a scalar, and the natural thing is to take the three-dimensional Ricci scalar. Now, for the particular form of the action, that is a square root, or if you want, from its reparametrization invariance, I have a primary constraint. In fact, if I define the momenta as the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to g dot, I have that they are constrained. They can't take whatever value I want. And this is what Dirac would have called the primary constraint on my momenta. And now, not every theory that has a Lagrangian is necessarily consistent and makes sense or has a sensible set of solutions. What you have to check is that the theory propagates its constraint, if you want. That's one perspective on that. A more modern one would be to ask that the constraint algebra, the algebra of Poisson brackets, closes. So this means that basically if the momenta are underdetermined by the speed and they satisfy a certain algebraic relation, I want that relation to hold at every time. I want it to be propagated by the dynamics. Now, in the simplest case of having R as the potential, I have that my momentum is this. It has this ugly square root here. And of course, if I take basically the square using the inverse supermetric of the momenta, I see that this square is equal to the potential. That is my primary constraint. If I propagate it, so I take the, one way of doing this is just to take the tau derivative of the, H is this constraint, I would call this the quadratic constraint of the theory. I just take the tau derivative and I use the equations of motion to calculate what I get. This thing is proportional to this guy here. There will be probably other terms, so I should have actually written a proxy here, so weakly equivalent to this thing here. This thing is something that doesn't disappear on the solutions of the equation of motion, isn't zero. If it was zero, I would have had a first class constraint. I mean, H would have been first class with respect to itself. But it doesn't, and that's because this is telling me that I have to introduce a further constraint in the theory in order for it to be consistent. This is the momentum constraint of ADM, of general relativity in the ADM formalism. It says that the momentum is transverse with respect to that metric. Now, I'm the mathematician of the 19th century. I'm surprised that I don't have a consistent theory. I want to make it consistent. What I do is that I add that constraint to the theory, and I have, again, to check that it propagates as well as the quadratic constraint. So I take its tau derivative, and it turns out to be a linear combination of the constraints that I already have, h, j, and h. So it's weakly vanishing, and the constraint algebra closes. So from the perspective of constraints, I would have a closed system, and I would be happy. Now, let's see what this new constraint does. You know it very well. It's, if I take a smearing and I calculate the Poisson bracket with respect to with the metric, I will get the lead derivative of the metric, which takes this form. This is the action of an infinitesimal diffeomorphism on the metric. Now, R action has a remarkable property. Since we chose the potential to be R, it's invariant under diffeomorphism, but only under time-independent diffeomorphisms. So if psi is a function of x but not of tau, so if it's the same diffeomorphism all over the trajectory, then the action has the same value. Now, I will give you this nice picture of the fiber bundle. Julian already spoke extensively about this. You have the base space, which is, in our case, superspace. So the space of Riemannian three geometries modeled by the three diffeomorphisms. I have a bundle that is generated by the action of the diffeomorphism group over this. I take a reference three geometry, and I can change it to a diffeomorphism. What one has to do to be consistent with the principles of what Sean, I think, calls Machian free endpoint variation is to basically minimize my action with respect to this diffeomorphism field, Xi. In this way, I just fix the initial and final three geometry. So I don't fix the three metric, just the geometry, mod diffeomorphisms. I take a trial curve in superspace. I lift it into a curved sheet, which will be generated by all the possible diffeomorphisms of the original metric. And then I take a trial curve here, whatever. This trial curve, I will be able to calculate my action on this trial curve. And I have to minimize it, but in a way that is slightly different from the usual variational principles. I don't fix the value of psi, basically, at the endpoints, because they are just gauge, so they're not forced to be here. This is not this or here or whatever. I can start with an arbitrary representation of my geometry as a three metric and vary with respect to that. So once I minimize with respect to these trial curves here, I have a preferred trial curve of the fiber bundle, and that will allow me to assign a value for the action calculated on this trial curve on the base space. This is the best matched action. It will satisfy further constraints. And then repeating this on all trial curves, I will get a further minimum or extremum, and that will be the solution of my theory. So let's see what happens with diffeomorphisms. I have to, if you remember what Julian did with particle dynamics, I have just to transform the metric with respect to this Xi, this infinitesimal diffeomorphism, everywhere in the action. Now, a funny thing that in the case of diffeomorphisms happens is that actually, R is explicitly independent of this Xi. Here, I have a tau derivative, so this tau derivative will hit Xi here, and I won't be able to integrate out Xi dot from the action. But I will be able to do that for Xi. The reason is that this action is, we can speak about an equivariant action with respect to diffeomorphism. a nice picture is this. You have the fibers and they are like parallel with respect to the metric we are considering. So once you minimize the action with respect to xi dot, that fixes you this angle. These are two nearby fibers. I have an infinitesimal step, an infinitesimal segment of the trial curve. And dl by the xi dot, you can easily see that putting this to zero will correspond to taking this angle equal to 90 degrees, so an orthogonal line here. But then, once I have the horizontal trial curve, it doesn't matter where I lift it. So it doesn't matter if I change the value of, here I have phi, by the way, I would have to write xi. It doesn't matter if I change this, because the action is invariant. It gives you the same value. Yes?
Why does the big G change under your...
Look, if I take a time-independent diffeomorphism, the indices are all saturated. So it changes, but I integrated it out. That's what happens with an equivariant action. So, but xi dot will... I will not be able to integrate out xi dot. That's the point. So what happens is that dl by dxi is basically trivial, is an identity more than a constraint. Yes?
I'm confused about one thing. If the action is gauge invariant, why do you pick up, are you picking up consequences of varying the gauge parameter at the boundary as an issue of the boundary term of the action? If the action itself is gauge invariant, why is there a constraint from varying the... I know it's a naive question.
It's not invariant under time-dependent transformations. It's just invariant under time-independent ones.
Right.
So, well...
So why... Does the best matching condition come from a boundary term?
I didn't say that. No. In this case, it's just... the best matching condition would be this two constraints, which in the equivalent case are one of them will be just trivial, will be a primary constraint basically. Does this satisfy you or
the delta?
What you do is you say you fix the left hand, you fix a point on the left hand side, and then you vary without fixing it on the right hand side until you pick up the horizontal position. If you fixed it on the right hand side, you just get a straight line joining them, but it would be at some angle. You wouldn't have the horizontal one. The free end point then fixes that you get the horizontal one. So,
right. So this is something that's happening at the end. The action is an integral over a parameter time, and
it's happening at each point, because these are just two infinitesimally close fibers.
Exactly.
So I'm doing the same.
Think of it in terms of changing the direction. You're really actually at one fiber, just changing the direction of one fiber and getting the orthogonal to the fiber. That's really what's happening. It's always nice to put it in small increments so that people like me can intuitively understand what's happening.
But I do that at each point until I get a curve that is orthogonal.
My question is very naive, and it's so naive. If L is gauge invariant by gauge transformation generated by C, then delta L delta C is zero identically.
Yes.
And there's no best matching condition.
Well, with respect to xi, there's no best matching. With respect to this, there will be.
But your slide says that selects best match section. So how does it do that?
It doesn't here. You're right. It does nothing here. That's just a preparation for the case in which this thing will be non-equivariant. Mm-hmm. Then I would have non-parallel fibers here. In that case, once I selected the horizontal trial curve, lifting it would change the action. And I will have to find the best...
it's not invariant.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. That's it. In this simple case, it's invariant, but it's just the simplest case. This thing is really useful when you have a non-invariant action. So, if we do this for the diffeos, now the action will look like this. I integrated out xi, and the variation with respect to xi is trivially zero. You see it; it's a primary constraint. while the by the xi dot will give you the momentum constraint. One thing that one could do is to consider xi dot as the dynamical variable. And since there is no conjugate momentum of that thing appearing in the action, that will behave just like a Lagrange multiplier. So I just write n, what you would call a shape probably, equals to xi dot, and I put that in the action, and the action takes a more familiar form. Now, what our 19th century mathematician has discovered is a form of an action for pure geometry dynamics that has been found in 1962 by Barland, Sharp, and Wheeler. And so they, I don't know if the motivation was that, but they basically found a way of writing the ADM formulation of general relativity in an explicitly reparametrization invariant form. So they basically integrated out the Laplace. And their action looked like this. And this is the extrinsic curvature, which is this guy. And it's loosely related with our momentum.
How would you, a 19th century mathematician, guess the DeWitt supermetric without having studied geometry?
I don't think they would have guessed that value. They would have left it. Yes, they would have the lambda. We will put that. We're just proceeding by steps for simplicity. Yeah, I don't think they would have guessed that at that time. We have problems guessing the value of lambda today, so I think that at that time it would have been even harder. So, so you can show the equivalence with ADM, actually, passing to the Hamiltonian formulation. It's easy. You just make a Legendre transformation. And you see this particular form for the Hamiltonian, in which this guy appears here and here in this way. If I just take this shortcut, I'm just doing it, I'm just going backwards in the Laplace, in the integration of the Laplace, basically. You take this shortcut for this quantity, and the action, the Hamiltonian will look like this. A sum of nh plus nihi. I also have to integrate by part this Lie derivative to get this. So this is the sum of the ADM constraints. Now, this thing has been studied by Julian and Brian Foster and Nilo Moroco in 2002. They published this result in which they show that this particular form of the action, the square root, is kind of rigid. It's hard to modify it and to obtain a consistent theory. It's what we showed is just the simplest choice, but what they did was just exploring the simplest modifications to that choice. So adding a cosmological constant, taking some power of the Ricci scalar, taking the square of the Ricci tensor, and also terms with derivatives, and also linear combinations of these things. Well, they were quite definite on the significance of this result, but let's just weaken it a bit and say that you end up in a mess, whatever you do. It's the message is that it's quite hard to find a consistent theory in trying to generalize what I showed you. You usually get a proliferation of secondary constraints. If you want to include them into the theory, you get further secondary constraints, and in several cases, they rapidly trivialize the theory. This was largely due to Nilo Moroco, who observed this. So you can see that this BSW action is just the simplest consistent, in the sense of the Poisson algebra, matter-free theory on superspace, which is based on a reparametrization invariant action with a local square root.
So now, this is the point that really puzzles me, that does it really trivialize the theory, or does it just fix the gauge? I mean, that's the same problem with lambda that people are talking about here. But I mean, somehow you think the small lambda is different from these guys.
Yeah. Well, I can't really answer you for the complete thing, but they explore. Let's say that it's difficult. It's hard. They didn't find an example. There's no theory. What?
It's usually rigid in respect to either of the lambda change or the potentials.
Well,
although there are a very few number of other combinations. Like, for instance, if the potential is only lambda, no R, nothing else, then any lambda will do. And that's the strong gravity.
Yes.
Strong gravity,
I also have a slide on that if you're interested.
There's a few different lambdas, so we have to.
Large lambda is the cosmological constant.
Okay.
Small lambda, let's call small lambda. There we go.
So this rigidity, it's very counterintuitive. So let's establish a small lambda. So do you think, say, the small lambda is excluded or not?
No, I will speak about that later.
Because
I will
not
give
excluded, then I find hard to believe any of these are excluded either.
Wow, that's not really immediate.
Well,
the
that
you can
part was a far more complicated than the kinetic term here. You say
so
space-time
if you get more than two secondary constraints at some point,
I explained the reason this morning, because if you have a potential which is different from R minus 2 lambda, when you try to close the algebra, you don't get just pi equal to 0 being sufficient, but you get essentially contractions of pi as a tensor against all kinds of Riemann tensor combinations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You have to keep setting all these things to zero.
Okay.
So when you set 2 to 0, the 2 degrees of freedom that you had at the beginning are gauge fixed, and then you're dead. So it's not that hard to kill the constraint algebra, you will agree.
This is a formal argument, but I find it hard to believe from perturbation theory point of view, because if you take that theory, that has a fixed foliation. And all of these other terms are small perturbations. So you're saying somehow I add these guys that just perturb my equations of motion slightly, and somehow that completely changes the nature of
because your starting point is inconsistent already, because you're looking at the theory with reduced gauge symmetry at the special point where all these terms.
No, but the lambda theory has a reduced gauge symmetry already.
But if you have a non-projectable theory and you don't allow the spatial derivatives of the Laplace function to show up in the action. For that particular case where that coupling is zero, it's a singular.
Okay, so if you do include the special gradients of the Laplace function, then we're fine.
There isn't any Laplace
outside of
the
proximal
numbers.
There
isn't any Laplace here, there's roots and steps.
Yes, we don't have the Laplace.
You get rid of the Laplace turning it into roots when the Laplace occurs only algebraically, like AD into VSW. If the Laplace has derivatives occurring,
okay.
Then the
maybe let's postpone that for discussions after. I'm really interested in discussing these things, but let's. Yeah. So now an interesting thing happens when you try to couple these things with matter. The simplest thing again is a scalar field. You have to change the kinetic term and the potential term. The potential term will contain an ultra-local part in the field plus derivatives, spatial derivatives of the field. And for the kinetic term, the simplest and basically only choice that have this quadratic in the derivatives in the time derivatives of the field and is Diffeo invariant. That is the form of the Diffeo invariant is basically always this Lie derivative with respect to the shift. That is forced by geometry on me. So for the potential term, I take something like a constant times this thing, which is this Diffeo invariant, just the square of the spatial derivatives, plus whatever potential I want. Now I have just one parameter freedom. I could put another parameter here, but it would be the same, because they would factorize in front of the action. So let's see what happens with this parameter k. The Diffeo constraint goes straightforwardly because it's manifestly Diffeo invariant. The propagation of the quadratic constraint will give you this term. So if you look at it, it is the product of k plus 1 times this thing. I could make the algebra first class if I added this constraint, but there are really three of them because it has this index here. So for a scalar field, I think that will basically trivialize the theory rapidly. So the only choice that I have is to take k equals minus 1. And what does this mean? I can show you with the equations of motion. If I take the equations of the Euler-Lagrange equations for this field, this is their form. They're not really nice in this form. But I can choose a patch, a region on which I have a flat metric, Euclidean metric, because it's only a special one. And I take the lapse equals to 1, and I remove the shift. This is basically the analogous of what Julian showed in the particle model when I choose the ephemeris time in some way, just locally. I can do that locally. And I get the equivalent of Newton's equations. These equations are D'Alembert equation with k that plays the role of the square of the speed of propagation of these waves. So the choice k equals, well, minus k is the square of the propagation speed. So the choice minus 1 enforces local Lorentz invariance. I can do the same for the gravitational field. So I can study small perturbations and calculate the speed at which they propagate. And that would be the most sensible thing to do, to compare the propagation speed of these waves with the light cone defined by the gravity field. And they're the same. So what I recovered is local Lorentz invariance in a theory which didn't have it. Didn't really. Yes?
If I may ask a question about the interpretation of this, it seems to me that this, if you look at this theory, once the algebra of constraints closes, this is mathematically equivalent to GR.
Yeah.
So why is it surprising that we get.
No, because I'm a 19th century mathematician and I don't know about special relativity. So I'm surprised. I say, oh, well, there's a universal light cone. I didn't put that by hand. Now, we know that from the equivalence with general relativity, but it wasn't really imposed on the theory. So it might say something about nature.
But I think this is a very important point, that you don't expect low energy violation of Bernstein symmetry if you have demand consistency. So whatever you expect to happen at high energy, at low energy, you cannot have different gravitons and quantum propagating at different speeds. Otherwise, you have a problem, right? So, and this goes back to all. This is the main problem, the main psychological issue that everybody has with bilateral Lorentz symmetry. And why don't we see it?
Mm-hmm.
And you cannot see it. That's what you're mathematically consistent.
So
long as the matter field is simple.
Yes, you might devise something that. Let's see that. So. The other generalization that they did in this original paper was to consider vector fields. And now things get just slightly more complicated. For the kinetic term, my lead derivative always plays the role of ensuring diffeo invariance. But for an inner product between the two velocities, I have only g. I have no small lambda freedom. For the potential, I can choose basically three independent terms which are quadratic in the spatial derivatives. And I'm going to do the semicolon because I want diffeo invariance. And for the ultralocal potential, I have only any possible function of this scalar here. Now, again, the diffeo constraint propagates without problems, while the Hamiltonian constraint gives you this monster here. I always write a prox so that it's weakly equivalent to this, because I cancel a lot of terms which are already first class. So. The three terms I get are this, this, and this, and this. These three can be put to zero with the choice of the parameters. 1/4 for alpha and beta and gamma equals zero. And the third has no such a freedom. But if we look at it, it can be made first class with this adding this constraint, which we recognize as the Gauss constraint of electromagnetism. Let's calculate the Euler-Lagrange equation in a Euclidean patch. That's what I get. These are not really Maxwell's equation. They are gauge fixed version of Maxwell's equation in a temporal gauge. And again, I can implement I have a constraint to add. I want to do best matching with respect to that. And the theory is still equivariant because you can see that the Gauss constraint generates gauge transformations with a smearing and a Poisson bracket. And you can recognize that the action, as I wrote it, is invariant by hand under time-independent Gauss gauge transformations.
So,
yes?
So What if you don't impose those constraints on the constants?
My dynamical evolution flows me away from the constraint surface, so I can't impose the Hamiltonian constraint anymore. I'm out of the Hamiltonian constraint.
It's not possible to do. You're saying that basically the theory becomes trivial or just...
No, it's inconsistent.
It's something.
Yeah. So I have the Hamiltonian constraint is an algebraic identity, and if it isn't valid anymore when I evolve, I'm in trouble.
But, if you go back, I could also satisfy the other thing, the terms vanish.
Sorry? I can also what?
I mean, all these, the black terms, not the...
Okay, that's your question. Yeah, I checked this. Again, you have too many constraints to satisfy. And you go down to 0 degrees of freedom if you try to do that. Yes. Yeah, you're right. I should have mentioned that, of course. That's basic. That's really the only thing that you can do. And so let's best match with respect to gauge transformations. I have to introduce this A node, which is really phi dot, the time derivative of the gauge field. I call it A node. And I put it there. And... of course, this is the thing that I want to get when I transform AJ through the gradient of this scalar. It's a three scalar. And DL by DA naught will give you the Gauss constraint with best match. Now, when I have this A naught, I can write again my equations of motion. And now they look much better. They look like Maxwell's equations with no gauge fixing. And the Gauss law, of course, will play the role of the temporal part of Maxwell's equations. And sorry, I didn't mention that. Yeah, of course, again, the light cone is satisfied; it is preserved because the Maxwell's equations are covariant, are Lorentz covariant. Now, add here with Julian extended this to n interacting vector fields, and I want. Show you all the details because it's kind of impossible here. But what they find is that with an ansatz that is basically equivalent with what I did with Maxwell, but with all the possible interactions between these vector fields, they get that to have a first class system, these C's, which are the coupling constants between the quadratic part here in the the coupling between two fermions, and also here in the kinetic term, these things have to satisfy Jacobi identity. So they basically are structure constants for a Lie group of some sort. So they any gauge group would work, I guess, would be a consistent theory. Semi-simple. So a sum of the simple groups, the direct sum of simple groups. Yeah. And Ed also generalized this to other cases. There is strong gravity, which is kind of interesting. I have a slide for this if you want, but I'll leave you for the end of my talk, and maybe we will want
so time.
What do you
mean by strong gravity?
With strong gravity, I mean a theory which has in which here in the action in the local square root, you instead of taking you take a constant potential basically. So. Something that has to do with what Levi Leblanc called the chiral group, I guess. Yeah. So the limit, the contraction of the Lorentz group in which you take the speed of light to infinity. So all points, spatially separated points, decouple, and there is no propagating interaction.
So it's
zero.
Zero.
Sorry, zero. Infinity is Galilei's group.
Opposite to Galilei.
Yes, yes. It's the opposite limit of Galilei. Yeah. So it should be relevant for the physics near the Big Bang, basically, near the cosmological horizon, singularity. And also, I think he extended this to Dirac fermions, but he just said me that he didn't couple that to Young-Mills theory. He coupled the scalar to Young-Mills theory, not the Dirac fermions. But they all work anyway. So that's the main message. So now, let's go back to our 19th century mathematician. He had no real reason to fix this to one. Yes?
I just wanted to clarify, so summarize what you've done so far. You're just showing that if you have a theory which has the exact same algebraic constraints as GR,
mm-hmm.
and to couple it to matter, the matter has to be relative to the matter. That's what you're showing for all these examples.
Yeah, well, yeah, basically, yes. I started from different principles, and then I find that the only algebra that works is the one that, yes. Yeah, it's best matching, and the local square root that
if you assume three spaces, then you find them all the matter components.
In magic physics, we don't assume it either, right? You want a couple better
to... No, we assume Lorentz covariance. We assume a four-dimensional diffeo invariance, if you want, when we get there.
The algebraic constraints has to survive the coupling matter, right?
Yes. So
assuming that algebraic constraints which happens to be the same as the finite form of this one, taking the Hamiltonian.
I mean,
it's stronger than that. It's not just that it's the same algebra constraints, but an attempt to go away from that leads to inconsistency or all the degrees of freedom being thrown.
Not so much, just don't read it. I'll leave it to the discussion.
15 minutes. Okay. Okay, we're going. Yes. Yes?
So your axiom has a special form, I mean, the product of square root. And so we did stable under order or something.
Is what? Sorry?
Stable under radiative correction.
Radiative corrections.
Is it stable under radiative corrections? Well, in the original thing, is you're speaking about this case, lambda.
Or no, just the action being square root.
Being square root.
I think the answer is it's not bound.
It's not bound because
this is a classical working of that.
There is the Hamiltonian constraint as a negative term, and that's something that it has been already pointed out in the. You can, I mean, Renate Loll, I think, already spoke about this, no? The fact that you have a negative term in the Hamiltonian constraint for GR. And yes.
But it's a different, you're just asking whether this form is stable under quantum mechanics.
Doesn't it?
Yeah, but this is not being, I think the answer is it's not known because it's not being studied perturbatively at this point.
Also, I have another question. So can you impose the volatility constant?
Here I don't have really a lapse. It's a lapse integrated.
That would lead to the narrow cross square root.
Mm. I think there's someone who pointed that out. You will get that. Anyway. So if there are no further questions, I would speak about this little lambda which entertained us so much today. In this case, there's no reason to fix it, apart from the fact that the Hamiltonian constraint, if I leave it free, is not first class with respect to itself. And I get this term, which is, of course, 0 if lambda is 1, times this guy here. So this invites us to add this constraint to the theory, P semicolon j equals 0. And the most general solution to this thing would be that P is proportional. P is a density, so it has to be proportional to square root of g, which is 0 under covariant derivative. Now, this constraint, as has already been pointed out, enforces a constant mean extrinsic curvature, so a particular foliation. Now, this y, which is the York time, I don't show you, is forced to be equal to the mean of pi in the sense of the integral of pi over all of space divided by the volume. If you take the mean on the left hand side and on the right hand side, you will recognize that. So I can show you that this means that this new constraint that I can add to the algebra generates volume preserving conformal transformations. So there are a kind of transformations that can be defined in this way. I take just a normal conformal transformation phi, so phi to the fourth, g transforms like phi to the fourth, and then I put a hat on it, dividing the conformal factor by this factor. Phi has to be positive in this language. I think people has used the exponentialized version of this thing before, but it's the same. And now, what happens if I take this constraint seriously? I end up with this theory that has been that's been written by Julian with Ed and these other guys here, in which they did best matching with respect to volume preserving conformal transformations.
But this
so
is back at lambda equals 1?
Yes, they did it with, for the case lambda equals 1. The fact is that I have...
Are you going to tell us? Because it would be,
yeah. Yeah, my motivation to consider that was because I had lambda different from 1, and this constraint has been forced on me. So what they did was just to start from first principle and assume VPCTs as the symmetry of nature. The funny fact is that it works also for lambda different from 1. And I mean, probably from a 19th century mathematician's perspective, that would have been the main reason for considering these things, no? Not wanting to fix the value of the supermetric and checking whether I have a consistent theory anyway. So I'm just citing the results. They work also for lambda different from 1. I will show you.
Your advantage, okay.
Yeah, so I have lambda equal 1 because I'm citing a work in which lambda was put to 1.
There is something different here, but there are two different routes of getting at this CMC surface. That is, it's not, is it clear whether there's a connection between the two?
One sure.
Is lambda not equal to 1, the other is imposing this conformal surface.
Hey, there are independent reasons for imposing these particular symmetries. In fact, people did this, and,
yeah.
And they are also present. But I'm arguing that from this perspective, one could have come to the same on the same grounds without having being really motivated by thinking that local scales are not physical. Yes.
Why is now this fixing of the spatial volume strong equation? Because this. Use this constraint
E
and
S,
so
weakly
proposed. So, I mean, in that sense,
oh.
The equation.
Why do I have a weak equation? Sorry.
The D is
this
your
one. If I impose that as a further
now
constraint.
You know, from that, that the mean of P is fixed. But this is also a weak equation. Yeah. So, it's just constraint acting on your
yes.
constraint.
Yes. It's not weak. If I assume that as a further constraint, it's, that is just zero. I don't probably it's, a bad notation. I shouldn't have written weakly equal to zero, right?
No, no. I think the question makes sense. You are imposing it as a first class constraint.
Mm-hmm.
It does, and anything that follows from that. Is true on the constraint surface, so that the
so that that has been what
so that
the volume is preserved.
So that y is equal to the mean of p.
Ah, okay.
So that should be a weak equation.
Should be a weak equation. Yeah. Yeah, you're
so
right. I didn't really write that equation. That's the fun word. So I just must be equal. Yeah, this must be equal. So it should be a weak equation. Yeah. It works when you impose the constraint.
The question is if you can conclude that only volume preserving conformal translations are allowed in not general conformal translations. Because I mean, if you just use D on its constraint surface, then it should.
But
just
when I didn't specify why, I could have put Y to zero here. Mm-hmm. Then I will show you that what happens is that basically trivializes the theory. But at this point, I could have put it to zero without. Yes?
Not to make your life harder, but. Couldn't y also be just a generalized functional of the metric and the momenta? Just an integral, let's suppose. If you're also assuming that that's somehow local, right? Otherwise, you could have some general thing. Some general thing would be
whatever. It does not depend on x will solve. We'll render this constraint first class.
But then it wouldn't. If it's a generalized function of the metric and the momenta, then it wouldn't generate.
No. Would generate strange transformations. Would anyway probably generate conformal transformations of the conformal type, but they will depend on the function that I chose, the functional that I chose there. I don't know. That's again, yeah, here there's. So this step is kind of not totally fair enough. It's probably the simplest choice in here.
Okay.
Yeah. There are a lot of simplicity assumptions that are hidden here and there in this sort of approach.
No.
So what they did was consider VPCTs. And now the action, if you want to perform best matching, the action isn't really is an equivariant or is an invariant under VPCTs. You have these terms. I should have had the 5 to the 8, I guess. I think I missed the factor. But anyway, the message is I have these things. No way that this thing is invariant. So I have to separately impose dl by d phi equals 0 and dl by d phi dot equals 0. That's the prescription. So from this form of the action, I have two primary constraints. One is a Hamiltonian constraint, a modified version of the Hamiltonian constraint, which depends on phi hat. And the other is this constraint that relates the momentum. It's not really a primary constraint. Yes. It relates the momentum associated to phi to the generators of VPCTs. Best matching tells you that this momentum associated to phi is zero, so enforces the CMC conditions. And this thing here, which n is still a shortcut for the square root of the ratio between the kinetic and potential term, and that's a consistency equation. I can't really include this as a further constraint and then propagate it. And the sensible thing to do here is a Dirac analysis. This is something that's fixing my labs and that's ensuring that I propagate the CMC condition so that all my further foliations will be CMC. And also, the Hamiltonian constraint now takes a form which is completely reminiscent of the Lichnerowicz-York equation. So York, following the work of Lichnerowicz, who studied maximal slicing, showed that he could solve the initial value problem of general relativity, generality basically, for whatever for all the signs, choices of signs of the curvature, and also, I guess, a general cosmological constant. I did this. First of all, you show that if p is a constant times the square root of g, momentum constraint and the Hamiltonian constraint decouple, because this y won't appear in the momentum constraint, and the momentum constraint will just tell you that the momentum, yes, I'm almost done, that the momentum is transverse traceless. Then the Hamiltonian constraint looks like this thing. It's the square of the traceless, transverse traceless part of the momentum, which is positive, minus this negative definite term, minus gr. Now, what he did, it was to transform this equation, which is kind of complicated, to a simpler equation for a conformal factor. So he assumed the reference metric, he conformally transformed it and said that this is the physical metric, and he transformed the problem into finding the conformal factor that makes this reference metric such that it satisfies the Hamiltonian constraint. Okay, so this is the equation, and it's an elliptic equation for phi. And what he did was to assume out of the blue a particular law for transformation under conformal transformations of the y, of the mean of the momentum. If one thinks that y is the mean of the trace of pi, he would have given it a scaling that is like 5 to the minus 6. So there is really no justification for that. Apart that, yes?
I wouldn't object to that.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, pi, so if you take just space time metric, it transforms weight 4, let's say?
Minus 4, yeah.
Okay. 4 minus 4?
Yeah, minus 4.
Then the spatial components will transform also with this weight. And the momentum always has the inverse weight. So that explains why trace free part has weight minus 4 and the metric has weight 4.
No, but
so, okay,
look at this. Look at this. If I have this, I expect pi to transform like 5 to the minus 4.
Yeah.
This will transform like pi to the minus 4. This whole thing will transform like pi to the minus 4.
Yeah.
G transform like pi to the minus 4.
No,
it's the inverse metric.
That's the inverse of G.
So it transforms like pi to the minus 4 because G transforms like pi to
yeah.
the 4th.
Okay.
Then this thing has to be invariant. Square root of G transforms like phi to the 6th. So why should one should have expected this? at first sight. Maybe it's naive, but
why is the contraction of pi and g?
That's not what York did, but if you see this in this way, y is mean of p, of the trace of p. So this is this thing here. What I'm showing here is that here this is invariant, but the volume that's the denominator won't be invariant. It will be only if I have a volume preserving conformal transformation. Yes,
yeah,
the mean is not exactly.
Okay.
So for a constant conformal transformation, I will get 5 to the minus 6 as expected. But since I have VPCTs, this thing is invariant, and that explains basically York's result.
Okay.
York never discussed this, but this was, I think it's a very relevant result that they got in this paper, you know, explaining this thing that allowed York to solve the initial value problem in general relativity. So anyway, at the end of the day, it is in this theory, which I call CS plus V, because it's conformal superspace plus volume, I get this set of equations. One is the Lichner-Wittig-York equation, one is the condition for having a CMC slice, and the other is the condition that propagates this foliation. Now, in the this theory isn't really consistent at first sight as it is, because it is a second class system. And I cannot, again, play the game of adding this constraint and trying to find a consistent theory in this way. I have to interpret this just as a gauge-fixed version of general relativity. This equation, again, as a... this is the mean of what's on the left-hand side, so this equation, again, has good properties and as a unique solution. And nothing, this is what you... how you should really interpret the theory you have. And if you want, you can perform Dirac's analysis to check whether it has sensible solutions. And we know that it has. It has been discussed already today several times. So you just take the solution of this equation, you smear the Hamiltonian, the quadratic constraint with that, and you get the first class part of the quadratic constraint with respect to the CMC constraint. It turns out to be only a single global degree of freedom. So you get this thing, this H global, which is a highly non-local Hamiltonian defined, and that constrains only a single degree of freedom, not a degree of freedom per point. And so I have added the constraint, this guy here, one degree of freedom per point, but I removed the 1 degree of freedom per point. I removed the constraint, 1 degree of freedom per point by this gauge fixing. So in this theory was the starting point for defining what Sean, Rick, and Tim call today shape dynamics. And they will speak extensively about this in the next talks, tomorrow, I guess. And what they did was really start from this gauge fixed theory and defining a gauge theory from that, which is different from general relativity, which enforces this VPCT symmetry. So to conclude, let's come back to lambda, of course. That was my first motivation to speak about VPCTs. If I take lambda different from one, all the steps taken by both the CS plus V paper and modern shape dynamics will go through. I will just have these terms that change some numerical factors in my equations, but they won't change qualitatively the equations if the lambda is within this range. Now, it has been discussed by Professor Rojava that out of this range, different things can happen. You can, and if you have lambda negative, you can even have a positive definite inner product. So I won't, yeah?
Why do you stop at 1? Why not lambda bigger
than 1? Oh, no, because if a lambda is bigger than 1, then... Yeah, you're right. I really have no particular reason to stop at 1. Yeah, it goes all the way to infinity, you're right. Again, you've been talking about this a lot, so I won't dwell much on the observational constraint on lambda. You, I guess you speak about this in this paper, that you have cosmological ways of constraining this factor.
It wasn't called lambda back then.
So anyway, there is this case of lambda 1/3, which is singular, because here you have this thing that blows up when lambda is 1/3. In that case, it's just you have to take a few steps back and observe that at the very beginning, the action looked like the kinetic term looked like this, and it involves only the traceless part of the velocities. So you basically have a primary constraint here. Since the momentum is proportional to that, the momentum has to be traceless. So you will not be able really to do all the steps that has been shown before. You will have to assume that the trace of P is zero, not Y, not a constant. It's completely zero from the word go. And in that case, if you write down the Laplace fixing equation, you see that it basically fixes out all of the Hamiltonian constraint. So in this case, the theory would be something that really is just a theory of a transverse traceless momentum and a conformal metric. I don't think that it propagates any degree of freedom. There are no propagating degrees of freedom in this case. And in the modern version of shape dynamics, that's what happens when you reach an infinite volume fixed point of the theory. And it really freezes out. And that's basically it. So, thanks. I'm trying to push Julian to finish a project which will contain all in detail all these things in a book, and may God help us, because really it's hard to get these sort of things done, but we're trying hard. So, thanks a lot. Yes.
First, we take questions to this talk, and then at the end, if there are additional questions to Julian.
Okay, coming back to this measuring the value of small lambda.
Mm-hmm.
This morning, we saw that whenever you have lambda not equal 1, then you get the second class constraint pi equal to 0, and then you can use the second class constraint.
Not pi equal to 0. You get that's pi equal to cont, or pi semicolon j equals 0. So what they wrote here. Tim amended that, but it was zero actually. So that is Tim's intervention.
No, this is where it seems absolutely flat. Right? That's imposed by boundary conditions.
Okay, that was your observation. Yeah, if you want to, asymptotically flat won't be compatible with CMC, of course.
I mean,
so.
Is it correct that you can eliminate lambda from the theory by this using the second class constraint pi with equal to zero?
No, you can't. Lambda stays there. And it is actually observable. I doubt
it. If it's zero, it's not observable. If pi is zero, it's.
If pi is zero, that's
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
If pi is. If you have Minkowski space and gravity was just happening somewhere in the body somewhere, then you couldn't observe it. But in a realistic universe.
Here in this interpretation, I think it's clear what lambda means. Lambda is the constant that sets the effective speed of the propagation of the scalar graviton.
Right. Right.
And then there could be two different theories. One theory in which the scalar graviton, like in this case, is a gauge artifact because there is a gauge symmetry. This could be viewed mathematically equivalent as a gauge dispersion of GR.
Mm-hmm.
In that case, the scalar graviton is not propagating, it's a gauge artifact. Therefore, little lambda is not a physical observable in that theory. You could have a theory where the scalar polarization of the graviton does propagate. For example, when you don't go through the gymnastics of imposing this constraint, you leave lambda arbitrary, you write down the generic Lipschitz potential for the theory, then the scalar graviton propagates and little lambda is a physical observable associated with the dispersion relation of that extra polarization of the graviton. So I think the interpretation of lambda is always dependent on the theory, and in this case,
this framework,
that
thing is,
that
would be hard to really to realize. All right, you would
here,
have to add
the
field at least.
If I look at this as a gauge dispersion of GR,
yes.
You get the same algebra constraint. Once you figure out that if you start with lambda not equal to 1, you need to add one more constraint.
Mm-hmm.
That constraint can be viewed as a gauge fixing condition of the GR
yes.
Boundary parameterization invariance. It is a lambda-dependent gauge fixing condition. Mm-hmm. We need to adjust the gauge fixing version of GR, but where lambda came only through the gauge fixing condition.
Are you talking about adding a U1?
No, U1. This is just GR plus matter. And the algebra constraint that you get after completing this gymnastics is just conventional GR with an extra constraint that basically you are saying, if I started the theory with little and not equal to 1, it looks naively like I have one fewer gauge symmetry because I have one less present class constraint. Mm-hmm. But then you realize that you need to add one additional second class constraint, and together with your first second class constraint, they form a partial gauge fixed pair. So if gauge fixed secretly time reparametrizations, by gauge fixing condition, it depends on little lambda. That's where little lambda comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes just GR with the
question. But that's a statement that's true for us asymptotically private space time.
The tertiary constraint you get is just the fact that you forgot to include the Gauss constraint because you started from assuming that you haven't had a space time diffeomorphism invariant theory, but secretly you have space time diffeomorphism invariant theory. The potential is any combination of scalar curvature and cosmological constant. So in that case, of course, can dial any value of lambda for which the gauge choice is non-determinate.
Mm-hmm.
Because lambda is not a physical observer. It's part of the choice of the gauge fixing condition. As long as that condition is regular, lambda can be anything and will not influence the physical observables.
Mm-hmm.
But if you were doing Lisch's gravity, where lambda shows up in the dispersion relation for the scalar polarization of the graviton, that's where it actually becomes physical observable.
Okay, I want to disagree with you, but I don't know how technical to kind of get. So there are two parameters, not just lambda. There is the other one, which is the coefficient of grad n. And it's the ratio of...
We've set that equal to zero for now. They haven't
included
that.
But, okay, so...
Analysis.
But to have a propagating scalar, you need both of them to be non-zero. If you set that to zero...
If we talk about what was just discussed in this talk, this does not have the propagating scalar.
Yes.
And therefore...
But it's not the same as GR.
It's the same as GR.
No, I disagree with you, because it's only the same as GR for asymptotically flat if you could set pi equal to zero. If you don't set it equal to zero, I mean, write down the equation, it's not the same as GR. And in particular, what happens is that the Friedman equation is different from that of GR. So I mean, I think it's true that it's a gauge fixed. You can interpret it as a gauge fixed version of GR, except that in cosmology you cannot fix that gauge. So that's why you don't.
That's what I'm saying. If to the extent that it's a legitimate gauge choice, locally it looks like a gauge fixed version of GR, and therefore locally things should be.
Locally is a covariant, but globally it's not.
It might be a bad gauge choice.
And that's why the only way you could test it.
What if you fix that gauge that way in cosmology? You have an observational constraint on fixing that gauge, or you have constraints on the global on the what?
It's for trillions that you have an expanding universe.
Hmm. No, yeah. But you're saying that you're forced to asymptotically flat from cosmological observations.
Yeah. So you're cast to a non-expanding universe. That's
That was actually my question.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's if Peter, if you agree with what was just said, then my question's been answered.
What was just being said? Which part am I supposed to do?
If
it might be a
whether you agree that
globally ill-defined gauge choice.
Yes.
So therefore, lambda different from one. In the context of the standard, as a modification of the standard, which you call the modern form of shape dynamics, is not equivalent to general relativity. This theory you were discussing just at the end is not equivalent to general relativity.
Locally it is, but globally it doesn't happen.
No,
I guess
it's constrained by observations.
No, I don't care about observations for this question. I do care very much about observations.
It's conclusively proven that it's a bad gauge choice, that it isn't secretly working out as a well-defined fixed.
Yeah, I think it's maximal slicing of FRW space-time. I think, it's conclusive that if you have positive curvature, it's not possible. If you have negative, if you have negative or zero curvature, it's possible, but it's very bizarre.
Just is it possible up to unobservable effects which are outside of the
model? Yeah, but so if, so then you're breaking the homogeneity at like in a very bizarre way. Because so I mean if you believe in cosmological principle that universe is homogeneous and it's dropping on larger scales, then you're picking your gauge that's very different from that. So the universe could in principle.
If you are local observers only worrying about what we can actually measure,
yeah,
maybe all the observables might be still consistent, but ignoring what happens in that region.
Yeah. No, I think this is the issue of the gauge. You cannot completely fix the gauge until you know the boundary conditions. And I think there are different ways of setting the boundary conditions. And there is one that I would think is cosmologically sensible, which is basically homogeneity on larger scale. But you can fix another one, which probably sets pi equal to zero, but it looks more and more inhomogeneous the farther you get from the origin. So that's what I'm thinking.
I could ask this question a different way. If you're not doing the spatially compact case, do you understand? Then there are boundary terms, and do you understand the boundary terms and the actions we've been discussing?
Okay, but boundary conditions are quite a problem in a Machian setting, no?
No. So I'm saying if you go out of the Machian setting,
okay.
Then general relativity has to be supplemented by both
yes.
boundary terms and boundary conditions.
Yes.
You need both. In these formulations of shape dynamics, has somebody worked on yet whether possibly you can have a non-Machian form with boundary terms and boundary conditions?
There's totally flat case.
Essentially, you can,
no?
I mean, you can impose finite boundary conditions. You have a boundary Hamiltonian. You don't change that for going to shape dynamics. The boundary conditions have to be compatible with a unique solution for each valid certification in the boundary.
Sure.
If that is given, then you can do the simple structure of shape dynamics that you can do.
Okay. How do you fix the super translation issue then?
No. This is not super translation. This is a compact universe with a boundary. That is much, I don't have an answer to that problem. Because we looked at those equations, but we couldn't find a new solution. In fact, I don't know how to proceed from that.
To make a comment, I mean, in a theory which has a lapsed end floating around it, it's easy to include terms that are like glad in. But in these other theories, that's a very problematic thing.
This is just
as can be seen by how you move from one walk to the other. You have the ADM action, you vary with respect to the end, then you have an algebraic equation for the end, you solve that, and then you substitute it back in. That's just an algebraic equation. If you had some differential equation there to solve, then the equivalent of forming a local like square root or something like that becomes a lot more complicated thing. It's generally only implicitly known.
We know how to get the square root out of a theory with the lattice function where the lattice is not showing up for gradient terms. We know how to generalize that setting while keeping the lattice to include terms that do depend on the gradient. We just know how to produce some possibility.
Yeah,
that would be a limitation of the spectrum
In fact, in order to get more complicated theories into forms that were relations, which I used as counterexamples to recovering special relativity, or deducing the equivalence principle, which were original claims to relativity theorems in the paper that confused themselves in the papers. Most of the trick was taking complicated matter fields in a space-time form, decomposing them into space plus time form, and then finding formulations of that that managed to absorb or rid oneself of grad-in terms. The grad-in terms were the main enemy that needed to be eliminated in order to find ways of processing forms within relation, and for some theories it was very difficult to get rid of. So there are well-known problems. And I would say that they are on the whole a weakness of this kind of square root approach, but actually you need things much more general than square roots in order to represent the theories that have to be formed.
I personally would try to stay away from square roots. I think there's a very precise analog here between this picture here And what in string theory is the relationship between the Nabokov action, which has the obvious
curvature,
and the Polyakov action.
Mm-hmm.
So when you integrate in the lattice function, that's like going to the Polyakov version of the action.
Mm-hmm.
When you integrate out the lattice, you end up in the square, which is like the Nabokov action.
Yeah.
But much more difficult to quantize.
Yeah.
So that's why I would prefer
mm-hmm.
having keeping the lattice and having the Polyakov
mm-hmm.
like.
Mm-hmm. The ones without the lattice implement this temporal relation into the deployments and then get this emergent mask in front. So then you get the things as emergent. So there's that motivation to do it. But then, yes, it is more technically complicated and there are prices you have to pay. At the very least, some of the workings are all to get the actions in the first place before I'm really done.
So I have a question for Peter. So why are you such a big fan of gradients of labs?
Because they are consistent with the edge symmetry. You can start by being kind of neutral on what the edge symmetry should be and write down an action which has this little lambda parameter,
uh-huh.
only two first derivatives of the metric showing up, and some generic potential. Then you can ask, can I close the symmetry algebra? And turns out you can do it if you declare that the symmetries are correlation preserving diffeomorphisms, but not more.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, once you realize that these are the symmetries that don't clash with the constrained algebra, you just allow in the effective action the most generic set of terms. And
right.
It turns out that if you use the grad of the log of the lattice function squared as the leading energy term with some arbitrary coupling constant, there's some bound on, again, the range of the coupling, but the value where the coupling vanishes is actually a single limit.
Singular in what sense? I mean, if there's anything.
Well, for example,
classically
it would then force you to not be able to include higher derivative terms in the potential because the algebraic constraints wouldn't close.
No, but I mean, this is.
That's one way of saying that.
So this gradient of log n
yeah.
term. So let's take as coefficients, and then I slowly makes it push it towards zero. And you're saying that there's a very big difference between it having an infinitesimal value and having it zero. You think there's.
Because to the extent that this has been explored, nobody has been able to take the limit consistently. So maybe I should weaken the statement to that.
Because I mean, I can tell you, I mean, if you look at the
clever way of doing that limit, but it looks like it's a single case.
Yeah, it's directly. I mean, because it's also related to his comment. Isn't it a good thing and not a bad thing if there's a way to formulate gravitational dynamics where the principle excludes curvature squared and higher powers of derivatives terms? Because we know perturbatively that as soon as you have curvature squared terms, you have a catastrophe.
No, we are talking about spatial curvature squared and higher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. But
because that's, of course, since it's independent of time derivatives, that doesn't ruin perturbative linearity, but improves the wave behavior. And might be an interesting
mm-hmm.
set of theories to look into independently of anything else.
Okay, I misspoke. I mean, assuming that you can get back something that looks Lorentz invariant on some scale.
At low energies, you want to become as Lorentz invariant as possible,
yeah.
certainly. But there might be interesting spatial higher derivative corrections that might
sure,
be
no,
and
use,
one
and use study.
At short scales.
Okay, so I was out of line.
Since we're talking a lot about it, and it was my enemy for around 4 years, I'd like to name it. The derivative of the lattice, the spatial derivative of the lattice, is called the tilt by Carol Kukash in his 1976 analysis of general vector intensive field spin with this one split formulation. So it's called tilt.
So you concluded that there's something wrong with the derivative of the lattice.
It's something, if the natural canonical theory written the ADM way contains this object and there's
yeah.
no way of reducing it, there's no way of telling what kind of square root or other combination
okay, so,
be,
yeah.
would be a relational action corresponding to that.
Okay.
So then there's a lot
so
of
that's that could be a problem with the relational
action. It can
action,
be a problem. No. It isn't always a problem because you can sometimes absorb it or you can integrate by parts as long as you get rid of it. It depends on how it features. So there's a few cases where you can get rid of it. But in general, if it's around, then there isn't any way of doing the equivalent of that that move, that multiplier elimination of the lattice that goes from ADM to VSW.
And the reason for that is that basically if you do have those terms, then typically this second class constraint that you get will depend explicitly on N. So you will be solving for N,
mm-hmm.
perhaps, to make that constraint.
But I mean, physically, if I just look at
just eliminate them and get some
look at the equations, what happens is that this propagating degree of freedom, as I take that coefficient to zero, it's the speed of sound goes to infinity. But I can push everything down to that limit, and I don't know what.
I would love to be able to make sense of that limit. I just personally not convinced I know how. So that's the level of the statement I'm ready to make. But if somebody can figure out how to make that limit consistently, I would be more than happy to.
But I guess these guys think it's consistent, right? Right.
I don't know. Mm-hmm. So far, we haven't heard anything about either.
The higher that part.
When you go back to the GR potential, then you can consider two cases. Either lambda is 1, in which case this is just straight GR, or lambda is not 1, in which case you discover you need one more constraint which tells you retroactively that it was GR but in a gauge fixed, partially gauge fixed version. So, lambda came through the gauge fixed information secretly. An open-end constraint analysis gives you the list of gauge symmetries.
Before it's already 5
seconds.
Yeah. So we should go to the bistro 6. Yes, I remember. Officially, this is now the break.
Yes,
thank you.